Dr. Yuri Fostinsky is a prominent author, historian, and journalist, and expert on Russia and the former Soviet Union. He has appeared in hundreds of print, TV, and radio interviews worldwide, and is widely known as co-author of the book Blowing Up Russia with Alexander Litvinenko, a former lieutenant colonel in the FSB who was poisoned with radioactive polonium in London in 2006. His latest book, Blowing Up Ukraine, The Return of Russian Terror and the Threat of World War III, was researched before the invasion of Ukraine, but is one of the first comprehensive investigations into the lethal methods Russia used since 1999 to take over Ukraine. And of course, we are talking today in the wake of another huge terrorist atrocity in Russia. And as ever, things do not turn out perhaps as simple as they seem on the surface. We're going to be diving into what we know so far about that event. Welcome to Silicon Curtain Podcast. Please like, subscribe, and definitely comment on the videos to help people discover the incredible speakers and their insights. Yuri, I'm delighted to welcome you back to the channel because you've been on a couple of times. And if people enjoy this interview, then I advise them very strongly to look at the other interviews and, of course, to check out your books, which are extraordinarily insightful.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the Terror Act. I mean, we've got lots of stuff going on, and some of it may actually be connected with this, things like the elections and the death of Navalny and so on. We'll come to those in a minute. Let's start with similar terror acts. And there's a universal question we have to ask. If you look at Beslan or the atrocity at Nordost, the theater that happened in the early 2000s, the key question always is, is it incompetence on behalf of the security forces that these events, you know, reach such a terrible scale of tragedy, or is it intentional? That seems to be a common thread of discussion.
Well, this is a question, of course, for which we are looking for an answer. It's probably too early to come to conclusions. What we know at this point is that on 7th of March, the U.S. Government or officials basically warned the FSB that a terrorist act probably might be happening in Moscow in the near future. Of course, after this, Putin gave a speech to the collegium of the FSB. This is kind of Politburo of the ruling structure, right? The Communist Party had Politburo. The FSB has collegium. It's an old structure. It was created in 1918 by Felix Dzerzhinsky. We do not really know about this structure too much. We know who is included, but we do not know what they discuss. So basically, Putin was saying that this is a provocation and this is the attempt of the United States to destruct people's focus on elections, etc., and we should ignore it. I think after 24 years of Putin in power, people around him know that if you are incompetent, you would survive, but if you are not loyal, you will be forced out. So I do not think that after, again, 24 years, well, 25th year in power, somebody would question Putin's opinion, and if he said that this is a provocation and we shouldn't pay attention to this, I think no one paid attention to this. And then, as we know, the terrorist act took place. Now, it took place in a place where Trump organized his Miss Universe event in 2013. So it's a well-known place outside Moscow. You are not able to have a terrorist to have an operation there, to organize terrorist act there, if you are not local. This is impossible. So the statements which we have from the Russian government so far, that all people who were arrested in connection to this terrorist act are foreigners, is misleading. They are probably foreigners, but they might be in places from countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, former Soviet republics. So they are foreigners, technically speaking. But if you plan to have a terrorist attack in Krokus City Hall, you have to know Moscow, you have to know that particular building. So the help probably was organized from inside. We were named several people who seems to be, again, people from former Asian Soviet republics, meaning that they're not Russian. They're definitely not Ukrainians. So the attempt of the Russian government to start to claim that Ukraine has something to do with this is a fiction. Ukraine has nothing to do with this. And if Ukrainians would organize this kind of operation, they probably would attack Ostankino or some, other buildings in Moscow, like Ministry of Defense or Lubyanka building. So this had nothing to do with Ukrainians, of course. Now the question is if the FSB was involved in preparation of this terrorist attack. Again, this happened before. This happened prior to the first Chechen War, and then how the first Chechen War was, announced and started, claiming that Chechens were involved in terrorist acts in Moscow in 1994. That's how the second Chechen War was started. It started with terrorist acts of September 99 in Russia. And after this, of course, Putin announced the Second Chechen War and came to power as the president on the wave of this kind of patriotism or whatever, the unity of Russian people behind the government. And I think by now it's clear to everybody that Chechens had nothing to do with those terrorist acts of September of 99, and indeed this was the FSB which was behind. And again, there are some we wrote a book with Alexander Litvinenko about this, but this is not the main argument and the main proof that this was done by the FSB. The main proof that this was done by the FSB was presented by FSB itself, because Chechens were not involved in that terrorist attack, even if you trust FSB's conclusion. Even according to their investigations, Chechens were not involved. Not a single Chechen was involved. And then, of course, the war started the day when two FSB operatives were caught red hand in Ryazan with the attempt to blow up a building, another apartment building in Ryazan. So I think we have enough proof to claim that the Second Chechen War was started after the terrorist act conducted by the FSB. What I'm saying is this: it's too early to say, it's too early to claim. We have to see how the Russian government would use, if they plan to do this terrorist attack in their own interest. For example, if we will see in the near future, like a week from now, 2 weeks from now, an attempt of the Russian parliament to introduce a death sentence for terrorism, then we would know, like 100%, we would know that this was done by the Russian government in order to return death penalty. Because there were several statements by Dmitry Medvedev, former president and former prime minister, in his Telegram channel, where he basically saying that the fact that Russia doesn't have death penalty prevents the government fight successfully against enemies, both local, domestic, and foreign. So if we see something like this would be an indication for us that the terrorist attack probably was organized by the FSB. If we see that the group of people involved might be huge and might include some Russian, names, right? Or then there is a possibility again that this was done either by the FSB or by some extremist within military structures or state security structures who would like to, well, to wake up Russians living in Moscow. Because you see, the irony is that Russia is involved in a war, which is very expensive in terms of lives as well. By all calculations, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people killed. And Moscow is kind of artificially left aside and lives normal life. And when you talk to Moscovites, they basically explain you that nothing is happening. They do not feel this war, they're not part of this war. And it's not by chance until yesterday morning, I believe, it was prohibited to call this invasion a war. I think it just now Dmitry Peskov for the first time used the war describing what's happening in Ukraine, right? So, but Russians are continuing to go to concerts, to go to restaurants, to go to visit exhibitions as if nothing is happening. So this is a wake-up call for Moscow as well, of course, and I'm sure that now a lot of people in Moscow understand finally that, well, something is going on around, right? That it's not business as usual. But again, it's too early to say whether this is ISIS or not, because it doesn't look like a typical ISIS operation, because in a typical ISIS operation, terrorists do not really think about surviving during the attack. They're mainly thinking about killing more and more and more and more people. And in this case, we obviously see terrorists who are not, trained enough, who are trying to escape, who are leaving the place even before they and to kill as many people as they could. So everything is possible, I guess. Although ISIS never, I believe, never organized operations in places like Russia. There are still questions how those people obtain automatic weapons, because it's not very simple in today's Moscow, which is, which exists in a format of war still, right? And taking into account that Americans, warned them about possibility of the terrorist acts, it's difficult to believe that this was organized from abroad. It was not. It was not. So we have to see how many locals were involved and what kind of locals this are. But mainly we have to see if the government would try to use it.
And
And because, yeah.
this is why the timing of the terror act, if there indeed is intentional timing behind it, and we don't know if it's planned or not, it's probably going to become clear through more details, but also the reaction of the regime to it. Is it possible that this could be used as a kind of Reichstag moment, a moment which allows Putin to escalate even further than he already has, the kind of violence and aggression that he's projecting out into Ukraine and possibly into other places, whether or not he had involvement in the planning, execution, and the timing of it? It is nonetheless something that can be utilized, especially coming after the election. It would have been perhaps been far more damaging during or before the election. It's happened after the election, and it's happened to the point where it's being acknowledged this is a war, and where it's quite clear that if Russia is going to make any kind of further gains, it is going to need to mobilize on a substantial scale, not just the economy that's already mobilized for war, but as you say, gather a lot more cannon meat or fodder to move forward.
Well, first of all, you're correct. I think if this would be If this would be a traditional terrorist act organized by terrorist, whatever, with certain political goals, of course, this would be happening either during the elections or before the elections, because then you actually obviously trying to, to damage Russian stability prior to elections of Putin. When we do this after elections, it's kind of too late. It doesn't make any sense. But we are going to see, and I think we will see it very soon, if the Russian government would try to use these terrorist acts for certain political or practical objections. To mobilization of the army is a serious matter. Ukrainians are struggling now in a situation when Americans stopped assistance, unfortunately, and it doesn't look that Biden would be able to break this situation and to change it and to come with assistance. I think Republicans who are operating under Trump instructions, which I'm seriously saying this, by the way, absolutely, which I'm sure came from Kremlin, came from Putin to Trump, and I think this was one of the reasons that Carlson went to Moscow to conduct interview from Putin. And I think this is one of the reason Viktor Orban visited Trump recently. This was a way to have this conversation between Putin and Trump, which is probably not very easy to do now under all this attention, which is paid by media to both Trump and Putin. If there is no American help, Ukrainians will be in difficult situation. And if Russia would be able to mobilize additional 100,000 troops, again, you need to train them, you need to equip them. It's not so easy, it's not so quick. This is not going to be 100,000 of professional, well-trained troops. But nevertheless, they have so far probably 600,000 people fighting in Ukraine. So this additional 100,000 still is a lot. Ukrainians will be under pressure. And what Putin is saying is, if you remember what Putin was saying during his interview with Carlson, that if the West stops the assistance to Ukraine, he will take it within several weeks. I do not, of course, think that that's how it's going to be, but what's important is that Putin believes that if it's not for assistance, then Ukraine will be taken, within weeks. That's why it's important for him to stop this assistance by any means. That's why he's frightening Europe and the world with nuclear strikes. That's why he's asking Trump to stop this assistance by any means, because he believes that this is the key to his victory. And if he is victorious in Ukraine, then again his mind tells him that, well, if the West loses Ukraine, then of course all other countries will surrender without fight, because now they would know that it's impossible to fight against the Russian Federation, which is ready to fight forever if it's necessary. So that's what's the problem is. And unfortunately, I do not see any light at the end of tunnel, at least in the near future. I believe that at the end, Russia will widen the front, and they will try, of course, through Odessa to get to Moldova, to have a similar war in Moldova, and Moldova, of course, is much weaker than Ukraine. I even was thinking that probably the easiest way to avoid Russian invasion into Moldova is for Moldova to unify it with Romania, because for those people who doesn't know, this is the same language, the same people, the same country. It just kind of artificially it was divided into two. But if Moldova would find the way to unify with Romania, then they would become automatically members of NATO as a part of Romania, and this probably would prevent the war. But again, for this you need a very quick and tough political decisions. You probably would have to conduct referendums in Moldova, referendums in Romania. I mean, Europe should be for it. The United States should not oppose. But this is the way. This is the way to prevent a war. Because looking back at the history of the Second World War, historians usually find several beautiful ways to stop it right in time. And the same could be said about the invasion of 22 in Ukraine into Ukraine. There were ways to stop that war before it started. And it seems to be very simple usually when we look at this as historians. So the to prevent a war, of Russian Federation war against Moldova is a kind of simple, but it's an unconventional way to deal with it. But that's the time. I believe the time changed after 24th of February 22. We started to live in different world, and we have to understand this, and we have to behave differently. And Macron's evolution from a person who was calling to Putin every other day when the war started, asking him to stop the war, right? To find other ways to talk to the Ukrainians, when Macron was hoping probably that Ukraine would agree to capitulate or to give part of territories to avoid the war, right? For him now to say that he's thinking about sending NATO troops into Ukraine. I mean, it's a long road. It's a long road, but this is an indication for us that 24th of February 22 changed many things for Europe, and we need to do everything we have to stop another war in Europe, because we know that both wars in Europe, first and second one, were absolutely devastating for Europe as for continent, and we have to stop it, and we still have chance to stop it, right? But for this, we have to make very extraordinary decisions, to think out of box, and we have to do it. We have no choice. Otherwise, we will have a full-scale war in the near future.
And already we see Putin trying to point the finger towards Ukraine, although some of the evidence coming out and the apparent admission by ISIS-K that it was their strike, their fighters, etc., seems to undercut that message of Putin. This is potentially interesting, isn't it? Because we always think of Putin's regime as an absolute vertical, with him controlling everything that goes on and being in some ways omniscient and pulling all of the strings. And of course, it is a kind of vertical hierarchy. But at the same time, it has been argued that Putin is often very slow to make decisions. He's cautious in some ways. Even in the lengthy war in Donbass, there were people urging him to throw more resources and more scale at the problem, and to an extent, he outsourced war and terror to Girkin and his forces and didn't fully commit. And he has been described sometimes as being fairly indecisive rather than the sort of strong leader. Is there at all the possibility that if this was not a so-called sort of organic, genuine terror attack, then it may be a way of putting pressure on Putin to go for the full mobilization, to go for full war, which is something he has visibly avoided doing in 2 years of the full-scale military operation?
Well, this is already what's happening, right? So, again, we do not know if there is a direct connection with the terrorist act or not, but number one, Peskov named the aggression in Ukraine a war. Number two, it was announced that Russia would need additional 100,000 people mobilized for the war in Ukraine. It's a lot. I mean, 100,000 people is a lot. It's a lot for Russia and for Russian economy, because last time when it was announced that Russia would mobilize 300,000 people initially for the war in Ukraine, not only those 300,000 people, of course, were mobilized, but additional 300,000 people or maybe more left the country to avoid the draft. We should expect something similar now, especially because Moscow stopped to be a safe town. You see, the Russian government purposely doesn't draft people from Moscow, from St. Petersburg, because they do not want these two cities, you know, to feel the war. And if you start to draft people from those cities and bodies are coming back, then people in Moscow and St. Petersburg start to feel the war. I do not know if this would still continue, these tactics. So maybe they still would avoid to draft young people from Moscow. But the fact that Moscow just, witnessed a terrorist attack, and a very bloody one, indicates that Moscow is not a safe city anymore. So what I'm saying is that in addition to 100,000 people whom they would try to draft, we probably will see another 100,000 people emigrating from Russia, because the border is still open. Now, these are young men who are taken from the Russian economy. And Russian economy, as we know, is working 24 hours, 7 days a week to support the war. So this might be noticed by population, by country, by economy. This is not going to be a free walk. It seems to be that after elections, Putin is going to apply more pressure for the population, right? To support his war activity and his war policy. He doesn't fight for popularity. He doesn't care. He really doesn't care how many people are killed. And historically, unfortunately, Russia is usually losing in any war more than any other participant. And usually we are talking about millions. Putin is not there yet. So he has still, a road to follow, following like Stalin, for example. If this is his ideal, and it probably is, but it's questionable if Russia would be able to hold this increase of pressure. We will see. Of course, we will see. I'm skeptical about the ability of Russia to change the regime, through internal opposition or internal uprising. I do not think that's what we are going to witness. I think all those people who were against the regime actually left the country, because that's what, that's what probably practical approach should dictate you to do, because it make no sense to fight against Putin, because you may fight with him only with weapons in your hands. And look what happened with Navalny, who was, trying to fight with the regime peacefully. And weapons, of course, are only in hands of three structures, the FSB, the so-called Rosgvardia, and that's another structure created by Putin, like his personal guards, and the army. But army traditionally doesn't play any politics in Russia, and the FSB, of course, is under Putin's control. So there are no forces in Russia to oppose Putin. He knows this. That's how they were, building this since 2000. So the reality is that there is no opposition, and they may do whatever they want. And unfortunately, what they want is to have this permanent war against the West, and that's what they plan to do. They're not going to stop. They're not going to change. They're going to proceed with the speed which is allowed by events. Again, when they invaded Ukraine in February of 22, the plan was that Ukraine will be taken or capitulate in a week or two, and then Russia would proceed further in Moldova and then to the Baltic states. But as we know, Ukrainians are holding for more than 2 years now, and the speed with which Russia is proceeding the invasion, of course, is much, much slower than it was expected. But instead of changing the goals of the foreign policy for the Russian Federation, they're not changing those goals, and they just are changing the tactics that, well, then instead of blitzkrieg, we are going to have permanent war. But we will win at the end. Or if not, we will kill everybody because we are nuclear power. And then if we are not able to win, we just destroy everybody. So this is the approach. And this is the approach which is kind of proclaimed to us by both Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev, who is very outspoken in his Telegram channel. And I actually ask everybody who would like to understand what Russia is thinking about the rest of the world to read those texts. They are extremely cruel, but very useful for understanding. So this is a serious war, and so it's not by chance Peskov finally agreed to call it a war. This is a war, and I think the open full-scale war between NATO and Russia is inevitable, unless, and I do not think that that's what's going to happen, unless US government would change strategy immediately, and instead of having as a strategy a situation when Russia is not losing the war and Ukraine is not winning the war, would change it to Ukraine winning the war and Russia is losing the war. All you need for this is to give Ukrainians weapons and permission to strike against the Russian Federation, including Moscow. And then this war could be won very, very quickly. Otherwise, we are risking a full-scale open confrontation between NATO and the Russian Federation in the near future, 25, 26.
Well, there are so many questions that come from that. I think we'll tackle Ponomarev and the non-vegetarian approach to tackling Putin. If we characterize Navalny's peaceful approach based on dreams, almost romanticism of a future Russia, we have Ponomarev and other forces who are, one would assume, under the control of Ukraine, making incursions into Kursk and Belgorod oblasts. And it seems to me that this makes the US extremely uncomfortable. And yet, these incursions are potentially one of the few ways in which it could persuade perhaps Putin's regime that the risks of this war are raising on their side. While the war is being fought on Ukrainian territory, is it not the case that there is really no risk whatsoever to Russian statehood, to the vertical structure, to the Silvia Key, to Putin himself? It's only by taking the fight to Russia on its territory and significantly harming its economy that you might force any kind of rethink.
This is true, of course, entirely true. And again, at this point, Ukrainians, not only they're not getting from Europe and the United States everything they would like to have, but in addition to this, they're not allowed to use foreign weapons, even machine guns, in their operations conducted against the Russian Federation. They are allowed to strike against their own territory occupied by Russia. This is allowed, and this is kind of, I mean, this would be a joke, but unfortunately, we are talking about a very serious situation. So they're allowed to strike against Russian Black Sea Fleet. They are allowed to strike against Crimea, but not against the Russian Federation. So the attempts of Russian anti-Putin forces to invade the Russian Federation from Ukraine, there is nothing wrong with those attempts, and I mean it's a good thing to do, except that they're not too powerful. They do not have enough troops for very serious military operations. And again, unfortunately, since Russia is a country of one city, Moscow, Putin really doesn't care about Kursk or Belgrade. So what's important is Moscow, and this is so. So the Ukrainians, of course, should concentrate on their ability to strike against Moscow. And the situation when Russia is striking regularly against Kyiv and other major cities of Ukraine, but against Kyiv as well, and Ukraine is not allowed to touch Moscow, this is a ridiculous situation. There is no way you are going to win a war without striking the territory of Russian Federation and mainly again Moscow, because as I said, Putin doesn't care about Kursk and about Belgrade, and he doesn't care about Russians. Everything in Russia is concentrated in Moscow. Everything, all businesses are there, all money is there, the richest people are there, politicians are there, the ruling class is there. I mean, it's Moscow only. Nothing else. So that's what you should do. You should strike against the Moscow if you plan to win the war. If you do not plan to win the war and plan to continue business like it was done for the last 2 years, I guess in a certain way it's fine from European point of view, or especially from American point of view, because Americans are very far away, except that where Ukraine is a much smaller country than Russia, and unlike Russia, Ukraine cares about people which is losing in the war, and the amount of those people is not unlimited. In Russia, in a certain way, it's unlimited. In Ukraine, it is not. And Ukraine especially basically is not able to conduct this war as a permanent war, unlike Russia, which rebuilt its economy and at this point is able to conduct this war forever, both from economic point of view, from the point of view of weapons, from the point of view of manpower, and psychology, because as again as Medvedev claimed in one of his texts, if we need dozens of years to destroy Ukraine, We will fight dozens of years, but we will destroy Ukraine. So this is not, of course, the Ukrainian approach, and it should not be. And then the if Europe loses Ukraine as a barrier which prevents a Russian invasion, then the situation would become worse for Europe, not better. And then in addition to everything, we have, of course, elections in the United States, which are coming in November. And we still do not understand who might be the president. And if this president is Donald Trump, we know what's going to happen. On 21st of January 25, he withdrew the United States from European affairs, not just from assistance to Ukraine. This would be, a terrible decision, but Ukraine would survive this, and Europe would survive this. He would withdraw the United States from European affairs, period. And then the nuclear balance in Europe will be destroyed because Americans, Europe would lose an American nuclear umbrella. And then having nuclear weapons in Belarus becomes a very risky situation because then Putin would, I think, inclined to strike with nuclear weapons from Belarus, kind of hybrid war, hybrid nuclear war in Europe, with understanding that no one would retaliate against Russia in this case. And it's questionable if you may retaliate with nuclear weapons against Belarus because it's a small country and radiation would, go across the borders. That's what I think might be a very risky situation. So indeed, taking into account that there is a chance that Trump would become a president, I would prefer this war to be won before 21st of January 25. But for this, you have to give Ukrainians weapons and permission to use it. And I'm afraid this is not what's happening.
We'll come back to that in a minute because Donbass and Crimea are pivotal to Ukrainian victory, and yet there seems to be a certain issue with letting Ukraine take those back. But let's pick up that theme on losses because it seems as well to me that a lot of the thinking in Washington, Berlin, particularly, is projecting a certain kind of geopolitical rationality or our rationality, which doesn't exist. There is perhaps the assumption that if Russia and Ukraine are engaged in an attritional struggle, at some point sense will prevail, and Russia, in some ways, cares about the losses, economic losses, losses of personnel, in the way that we might. Maybe it's slightly skewed, but it seems the thinking is still to project our values onto Russia. You're saying, however, that there perhaps is no limit to what Putin is prepared to waste and annihilate in order to get his aims. And this is perhaps a fundamental misreading of the mindset of the Kremlin and those surrounding Putin by the Western powers.
And probably the main one. You see, everybody was thinking or hoping that as soon as Russia would understand that Ukraine is not going to surrender, that Ukraine is going to fight, that this decision is very, serious, and Russia is looking for a full-scale war, again, Putin would change the strategy and say, all right, guys. Okay, you do not want to surrender. Well, let's talk about something else, right? But that's not what happened. And Stalin was losing in all wars which he conducted, and he conducted many wars, including, of course, the Second World War as well. Stalin was losing millions of people, millions of Russian people. And According to public opinion polls in the Soviet Union and in post-Soviet Russia, he is one of the most popular politicians. Because what counts in Russia, not how many people you killed or how many people you know were killed, but how many victories you achieved. And that's what Putin, I think, believes, that it's not really important how many people are killed, and that Russians indeed do not really care if they are killed or not. And traditionally, Russian life is very cheap, almost cost nothing. But what's important is if you are bringing new territories and become and you know helping Russia to become an empire. And this was sold, by the way, the idea that Russia should be an empire, that Russia should exist as an empire. This was easily sold to public. And you will not find too many Russians, including those who are against Putin and against the war in Ukraine, who would tell you that they do not believe in empire, that they do not really believe that Russia has to exist as an empire. I mean, these are nice people, educated people. They do not want to have a war, but openly or deep inside, they still believe that there is nothing wrong for Russia to exist as an empire, while for everybody else, it's a wrong approach. And I will give you an example. I mean, not an example, but what's actually is happening. When Putin is saying that the collapse of the Soviet Union is geopolitical catastrophe and a major tragedy for Russians, and that Russia has to exist as an empire, everybody is considering this. I mean, it's not that everybody is happy about this, but everybody is considering this. I mean, well, do Russia have this claim to have Ukraine? I mean, they had it for some centuries. I mean, maybe there is something here, right? Maybe some other republics actually should belong to the Russian Republic because they always were. I mean, we are discussing this as if this is a normal claim. Let's say, for the sake of the argument, that a king of Britain would say tomorrow that the collapse of the British Empire is a major geopolitical catastrophe and tragedy for the British people, and he would like actually to rebuild the empire, to return to empire status. What would be reaction for this in the Great Britain and outside? What if Erdogan tomorrow would say that the collapse of the Ottoman Empire was a major geopolitical catastrophe for Turkish people, and he would like, to rebuild his empire? We would think that this is ridiculous. But when Putin is saying this, we are discussing it as if this is a normal claim. So this is a problem which is not just Russian. It's also a problem of the other world, right? Other countries looking at Russia as if it has the right to claim what other countries are not allowed to claim, basically, right? And so partially in what's happening, the civilized world is guilty as well, because in 2006, during an economic conference in St. Petersburg, where all heads of the states, in major states at least, of Europe were present, Putin actually said that they would like to have Belarus and Ukraine back. and n not a single voice was raised against this statement. Then in 2007, of course, in Munich, Putin basically was saying that he's unhappy with the United States trying to build, one polar world. And Russia actually would like to have a multipolar world. Indeed, it's all the opposite. The United States is building multipolar world where all different regimes and different kind of governments exist, while Russia is trying to have, of course, everybody under Russia's control. So that's how it started. It starts with claims. It starts with ideology. It starts with rhetoric, but then this rhetoric becomes reality. And then Russia tries to invade Georgia in 2008, and basically no one is opposing. And then it takes Crimea, and again no one is opposing. And then, of course, it starts a full-scale invasion to Ukraine. Now, for the first time since 2002, of course, there is a real opposition to what Russia is doing. But again, unfortunately, we are talking about a unique situation when, for the first time in world history, a major state, nuclear state, is controlled by the state security, not by political parties, not by monarchs or dictators, but by a state security as the institution. And these people were, formed in 1917, in December of 1917, in order to kill, in order to take, in order to fight. And that's what they are trying to do, and that's what they are doing without any political control. In the Soviet Union, KGB was existed as well. Of course, this was similar, the same, kind of structure. But it had political control in a form of Communist Party. This was not the best political party in the world, of course. But at least they had this conception of peaceful coexistence with the West. Unlike the KGB, which is now the FSB, has a new conception formulated by Putin that Russia could win a nuclear war. And this is completely opposite to the theory of peaceful coexistence, which secured the world, well, until recently, I would say. So that's what the problem is, that we are dealing not with the with political parties which are ruling Russia, not with normal government which is ruling Russia. We are dealing with the FSB. And it's not by chance that Putin mentioned twice in two documentaries. One was made, well, by his order, of course, about the invasion of 2014. And he was saying that the decision to invade was taken by three chiefs of the FSB, Putin as former director of the FSB, Patrushev as former director of FSB, and Bortnikov, the current director of FSB, of the FSB. And the decision to invade in 22 was made by same three people, Putin, Patrushev, and Bortnikov. So these are people who rule Russia, and this is not the Russian parliament, which basically doesn't exist. This is not the cabinet of ministers, which is just a technical help. But three triumvirate from three directors of the FSB. And these people are trained to kill. They are not trained to negotiate.
They're also trained to lie. One of the questions that I wanted to ask is, what are the features of not just Russian propaganda, but public figures, public communication? That behavior is then copied down through, the Z patrons and so on, but is almost a pathological need to lie continuously and lie on a scale that Goebbels would have been, I think, impressed at. What is the source of this use of vranio or lies as an instrument of coercion, aggression?
Well, we are talking about a country which, and I do not really want to go too much into history, but we are talking about a country which was absolute monarchy until 1917, communist dictatorship until 1991, had very short and very troubled period of attempts to become part of Europe and to become democracy in a period between 91 and 99. And then became again a dictatorship under the FSB. So the democratic period of Russia has a short history of 9 years, and even those 9 years were not ideal. And the freedom of press, which existed in Russia, probably existed between 1990 and 2000. From the day when Putin became president, they started to shut down and to confiscate oppositionist newspapers. And the first empire, which was unfriendly to Putin, was empire of Vladimir Gusinsky, who had his well-known channel NTV, which was well respected, and they shut it down. Then they started to close his newspapers, etc., etc. In 2003, they arrested Michael Khodorkovsky, who positioned himself as an independent businessman with the attempt to influence Russian politics, and they ruined his company, Yukos. They just in the recent weeks, by the way, Yukos won finally a criminal case against, well, civil case, I probably should say, against the Russian Federation, and now the Russian Federation is obliged by international court to pay, owners of Yukos, $50 billion. I actually would like to see how this is going to happen, but anyway, after 2003, even oligarchs stopped to exist in Russia. They became just rich people on the conditions that they are allowed to be rich as long as they support the government. So this is a very short history of freedom or democracy in Russia, and this is the answer to the question why it's very easy to lie. Because that's how Russian people lived for generations and generations and generations. And again, taking into account that life is very cheap in Russia and Russians are very cynical because of this, and they do not really expect to die of natural for natural reasons. They expect that something would happen to them. That's why you see except for small percentage of people who emigrated who are not happy with, what's happening in Russia and choose to emigrate, but the entire country cannot emigrate. This has never happened in world's history. So the majority of people, of course, are either supporting what's going on or basically do not care, right? Kind of neutral. And that's why you have this Russian propaganda, which is one-way street. There is no return connection, right? There is no really connection between a TV set, which produces some information, and listeners on the other end. They do not care whether people believe them or not. There are no public opinion polls which, collect information about this. We do not really know how popular Putin is, and he doesn't care if he is popular or not. Beyond the fact that it's officially said that he had like 87% of support, what is ridiculous. He could not, I mean,
And
it's
that's more than
obvious,
the previous
could not.
elections, isn't it? It's actually gone
Pardon?
up with each election, the
It's going
proportion of
up, it's
his,
going
yes.
up. And that, I think, what was happening. You see, after annexation of Crimea, the Russian state media was saying that 86% of Russians supported occupation of Crimea. And I mean, I do not know if this was 86, but it was true that the majority of Russians speaking about imperialism and the desire to become an empire supported the occupation of Crimea, especially because it was, conducted without bloodshed and without real war, and just one person was killed. We could believe that majority of Russians supported the occupation of Crimea. But those people who were thinking what percentage they should write for Putin knew that they could not go below 86, because then the conclusion would be that Putin lost some votes because of war, because of real war in Ukraine. So they decided to go higher, but just a little bit. So, people would kind of believe this. And so they came with 87 point whatever, 2 or 0.4. But the problem is that in Russia, by law, the electoral computer, which calculates the votes, is controlled by the FSB. This is a joke, but I mean, this could be a joke, but this is by law officially. And they also introduced some time ago a remote voting system, which would be great. I mean, in places like Russia, a huge country where there are no roads sometimes, and people would need to travel who knows where to vote. To be allowed to vote remotely, this would be great. Except that in Russia, this of course gives the government the opportunity to add to a favorite candidate those votes of those people who did not come to vote. And that's precisely, of course, what's happening. That's why these elections, unlike any others, not only they conducted them for 3 days instead of 1 day, but they also, of course, claim that more people participated in this election than in any previous ones. So it's a
Barely
wow,
credible, barely credible, isn't
wow,
it?
right, wow, complete victory for Putin, of course. But I guess it doesn't matter even for him whether this complete victory or not. What's important for him, if he would be able again to collect those 100,000 people for the fighting in Ukraine, and whether he would be able to continue with his war, because he's not ready to stop.
And my last question is really central on that. It's the lack of imagination, the fact that we have not just parted from our imperial pasts, we have perhaps forgotten the techniques that we used to coerce and control the populations that came within our empires. We've moved on and forgotten what that was like and what we did. And therefore, it's difficult, I think, for us to imagine what Russia is capable of. And difficult for us to understand the techniques, even though they are relatively simple and they're repeated over and over. If we are to stop Ukraine, stop Russia in Ukraine, I think it's perfectly possible. We're not doing it because we fear they will escalate against us with nuclear weapons and so on. But there are other scenarios for Russian behavior. One of those scenarios would be that if they are stopped from advancing in Ukraine, well, there are other territories that formed part of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Empire, and that is Central Asia, Georgia, Armenia. And propagandists have been making ongoing threats to all of these places whenever they express any kind of independence from Moscow, whenever they use their native languages. as opposed to Russian and exert their cultural identity, they get extraordinary threats made against them. The aggression of Moscow won't go away. I don't think we appreciate that, but that aggression could be directed at other places if we push it back from the frontiers of Europe. Do you think this is a risk? And should we try to imagine all scenarios?
Well, no, I think it's actually the opposite. You see, the only problem with Russia, and there are a lot of people usually when we have conferences, right, or discussions, the question is, what's wrong with Russia? Actually, nothing is wrong with Russia, and nothing is wrong with Russians, except that Russia has to stop about itself, as if it has at must to exist as an empire. This is the only problem with Russia. Everything else would work perfectly. Russians just have to stop to believe that Russia should exist as an empire and that Russians are very special, and you can just couldn't compare them with other nations or other countries, because it's ridiculous, because the Russians are great, while all other people are not. And this is a sincere belief, which you see every time you start to talk to Russians. And
even some opposition Russians. I mean, let's face it, there's an exceptionalism.
Even educational, educated Russians, even these who do not believe in war, and to those who hate Putin. But still, they would have difficulties if you ask them if, you know, a Russian and Chechen are equal, and say, well, or a Tatar, or a Ukrainian, or a Belarusian, or any other nation. Actually, you probably will hear the same answer if you ask them if a Russian and Englishman are equal. Probably not. And the argument which you will hear, what is also very interesting, that, well, look, you know, there is a great Russian culture, you know, Pushkin, Lermontov, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Tchaikovsky, you know, Brodsky, Solzhenitsyn. And then you look at those people, you know, who are actually, you know, representing the great Russian culture. Pushkin was exiled, punished, and in jail, killed, you know, during the duel. Lermontov was exiled, punished, and at the end killed in a duel. Tolstoy was excommunicated by the Russian church. Dostoevsky was sentenced to death. They went through kind of execution, and at the end was not executed, by sent to Katorga, right, to you know, to Siberia for many years. Solzhenitsyn was sent to concentration camps. Brodsky was exiled. Tchaikovsky actually was basically, killed because he was a gay, and you know, because of this, the society did not accept him. I mean, every other, you know, Mikhail Bulgakov was basically killed. Mandelstam was killed. Akhmatova, a Russian poet, her husband, another poet, Gumilev, was killed, and her son was put in prison. You could take any person. They survived and became part of the Russian culture, not because of the Russian state or Soviet state, but, despite the attempts of the state to murder them. And at the end, many of them were killed. So, but that's what this is forgotten by those Russians who are arguing for great Russian culture and great Russian state. And unfortunately, they somehow think that the stronger the state, the better is for nation. Indeed, this is a very questionable theory, generally speaking. And in case of Russia, this is completely wrong. The weaker the state, the better for people. But again, that's not how Russians are educated. Russians are educated in a way that what's good for the state is good for you. Again, this goes against basically the Western understanding of the life. Not necessarily what's good for you is good for you, and the state has nothing actually to do with this. The state is a state, and your life is your life. But that's what's wrong with Russia. Russians have to accept the fact that a period of imperial period is over. I mean, it was over in 1918, but it definitely was over in 1991, and they should forget about imperialism and should think about the self as a just another, European or Asian European nation. Then everything would become normal in Russia. But unfortunately, as we know from the lessons of the Second World War, looking at Germany, looking at Japan, in order to change, you have to be defeated in the war. And this defeat will come. That's what's happening now. Russia started the war where Russia will be defeated. The problem is that we do not know how long this war would continue and what the price of this defeat is going to be for both Russia and the world. This is still an open question, but I'm slightly, well, nervous about our future.
And of course, it requires people to accept not only they're defeated, but for the propagandists, the media infrastructure, the leadership to accept that truth rather than to spin further lies. I remember drinking beer on the roof of Ingo in 1990 with some friends and Russians. And, the question that came up is, does this country know it's lost the Cold War? And we came to the conclusion back then that no, it hadn't accepted that it had lost. It hadn't accepted that that was over. And I think it was quite clear, even before that liberal period set in, that there was no such conception of empire. There was deep regret and nostalgia for various territories that had been lost, Eastern Europe, the Baltics, and so on. There was a high degree of resentment, but no concept whatsoever that the core of the Russian Empire had ceased to have meaning. And here we are, however many years later.
Precisely. And also, again, we're talking about lessons of history or mistakes which were made. The one obvious mistake, well, this was an obvious mistake, but I do not want to sound as a person who claims that this was easy to do. The crimes committed by Communist Party was never actually, discussed by the nation. The crimes committed by the KGB was never discussed by the nation. And that's why the communists, of course, did not survive for the 1991 collapse, but the FSB did. And this is the price we are paying now for not not sentencing both the Communist Party and the KGB for crimes committed against humanity during the period of 1917 to 1991. But again, I do not want to say that this was easy to do. This was not, because the FSB, the former KGB, was in many ways in control all those years, despite of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And again, they came back, as we know, very quickly and took power very quickly. And historically, you know, the democratic Russia existed for 9 years, which is nothing, right? And in 2000, it was already under the control of the FSB. But that's what should be done. And will it take time? Yes, it will take time. And I think we know how long. We think we know how long it took Europe to pardon Germany for crimes committed during the Second World War. And I would say that it took probably 70 to 80 years. And I expect something similar to happen after this, the end of this war, because, you know, Ukrainians probably would never, you know, pardon Russia for what Russia have done. And probably all those people who live in both Russia and Ukraine would have to be gone first, and only new generations would start to look differently at Russia. And this probably would relate to Europe, especially if this war widens and if Russia would try to attempt to invade other countries, what I think is very possible. And Germans just published reports that they expect this invasion to take place in 25. Prior to this announcement about a new 100,000 people, I was thinking that Russia would not have troops for this invasion, but maybe this new 100,000 is going to be dedicated to fight against other European nations. So we will see. But it doesn't look too bright for us. It doesn't look the future doesn't look peaceful. And once again, I think Europe has to be ready for war. If we would be able to avoid it, this would be great. But I'm not convinced that this is possible, because it's the aggressor who actually decides to attack and to invade. And there is nothing what you could do against this. We couldn't do anything in case of invasion of Ukraine in 22. I mean, we probably could, but we didn't. And I do not know how much we could do to stop Putin from further invasions, if he plans to have them.
And the very last thought on that, again, it's a failure, I think, of our imagination, because we try to look for patterns in history, and because we don't see those exact same patterns, we don't see the warning or threat. So because Russia isn't behaving exactly like Stalin's Russia or like the Third Reich, because it's following a different course of events, we perhaps don't see the scale of the threat. One of those, of course, is the Gulag. And it seems to me that the FSB has re-established the Gulag, but because it is not in the traditional place where it is in Siberia, it's not on that same scale. They've established the Gulag in Donbass. They've outsourced it as part of the SVO, the special operation. And the scale of torture, impunity, illegality is all there on the territory of Donbass. And of course, it's, you know, if they want to exile people to their deaths, people who support Navalny went to lay flowers on the Solovetsky stone or do something, you know, more demonstrable than that, well, they've got a very easy gulag to send them to, and that is to the special military operation where they will not survive and come back from. Again, I think we fail to recognize this process of terror that is unfolding.
Well, we also have difficulties to imagine that something irrational is going to happen, right? Let's put it this way. In 2013, not too many people would expect that Russia would invade Crimea. If 2021, Not too many people were expecting that Russia would start a full-scale nuclear war. We probably could say the same about the Second World War. Not too many people were expecting in 1938 that Germany would start the Second World War, as a result of which 60 million people will end dead. So our expectations are usually much less dramatic than the reality. It's probably normal for people, but it does not really help us. Soviet Union existed in the format of closed borders and without market economy. The Stalin, of course, was killing people by millions. Today's Russia exists with the open borders, with market economy. Now, this allows those Russians who are unhappy, let's put it this way, to immigrate from Russia to some other countries. And by the way, when you travel now, you see those Russians, there are a lot of them, and this is the main language, except the native one, in basically every country, in Georgia, in Lithuania, in Poland, Kazakhstan,
Uzbekistan,
anywhere, frankly.
Mongolia,
And this is, of course, an indication that a lot of people were unhappy with what Putin is doing. But this does not. But this allows Putin to exist and conduct his activity without major terror. Because if the border is closed and if all those people who are against him, if they're inside the Russian Federation, then of course you have a comparatively large oppositionist movement in Russia, and probably the government would be forced, of course, to apply terror to those people, arrest them, put them in prisons. There is no death penalty, so you cannot execute them, so you have to hold them somewhere. And I think the decision was made by Kremlin that it's actually safer for them, for the regime, to keep the border open. So since the entire country could not immigrate, then of course only those people who are fine with what's happening are left in Russia, and those who are not happy and those who are in opposition, there are not too many of them, and those you always could put in prisons, and we see this like several thousand people probably who were arrested and are in prison for their political thoughts and activity. But again, this is a format in which Russia seems to be could exist forever, because again, there are no internal forces which could change the regime, and people who are in charge of Russia, they're not going to give power away. I mean, this is not going to happen. It's not that at one particular point Putin would say, all right, fine. I mean, he's not Franco, in other words. This is not a case of clever dictatorship, right? Or educated to monarch, right? He is lieutenant colonel of the FSB who just happened to be president of Russia and happened to hold this position for a quarter of the century. But he's still a lieutenant colonel of the FSB, nothing more. And we intend to forget this. We think that he is like, well, Great Putin. He's not Great Putin. He's Lieutenant Colonel of the FSB.
Yuri, Thank you so much for speaking to the channel. It's always extremely thrilling and compelling, and obviously dark and terrifying at the same time. I think your insights are incredibly important at this moment in history, and I hope some decision makers hear your voice and others like yours, and alter their strategy before it's too late. Thank you so much for coming on the
Thank you
channel
very
again.
much. Thank you for your time.
Brilliant.